From the pages of The Skeptic magazine, you're listening to The Skeptic Podcast. Since 1987, The Skeptic has been publishing expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and claims of the paranormal. Here we bring you selected articles from The Skeptic since its relaunch as an online news source in September 2020. I'm Michael Marshall, editor of The Skeptic, and first up this week we have Wendy Grossman's article, IQ Tests Continue to Flourish in Spite of Inherent Biases Because We So Badly Want to Feel Special, first published in December 1989. Mensa hit the news in August when they launched a search for Britain's 1,000 brightest children in the Sunday Times. Later they admitted it was a stunt to attract media attention. They may have gotten more than they wanted. On the 14th of August, The Independent reported that educational psychologists said the tests Mensa were administering were culturally biased towards white middle-class children, and pointed out that the test assumes that intelligence is based on the ability to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic. Einstein and Leonardo da Vinci, two of the greatest brains to have ever lived, both suffered from dyslexia. This is neither the first time Mensa has searched for so-called gifted children, nor the first time IQ tests have been criticised. And yet, we continue to believe, paranoically, in IQ test scores, and a society based on them continues to exist. This is not sour grapes on my part. I was trawled in just such a child testing exercise when I was 14. This is, by the way, a matter of deep embarrassment on my part, so I do hope you won't tell anyone. Same routine. Mensa supplied a test to be taken at home, supervised by parents. Those who passed went on to some sort of central testing place where the tests were supervised by Mensa flunkies. It's hard to see why people think testing at home encourages cheating. Since you have to take a supervised test afterwards, where would cheating get you? Certainly in my parents' house, these things were taken very seriously and no trickery went on. I found the tests ridiculously easy and was sent on for the supervised tests. I remember my mother posted my final score and my letter of acceptance from Mensa on the refrigerator, proudly. I was enrolled and I began to get Mensa newsletters. I think I went to one meeting. It was all adults. Mensa had no idea what to do with the 14-year-olds they'd recruited. When I was 17, a new friend said, rather forcibly, that the idea of Mensa was snobbish and, worse at that time, straight. I resigned, over my father's protests. I like reading the newsletters. I told him he should join himself. I guess he thought he wouldn't qualify, even though he always used to say, "You got it from somewhere, you know." People talk in the British press about the damage that being labelled not clever could cause. I had the opposite problem. I was an underachiever. I could think quickly and score well on standardised tests, so why wasn't I an A student? My IQ scores pursued me like an animated yardstick in a cartoon. Of course, the school would never tell me what they were. I'm not sure why, but I gather asking what your own IQ score is a bit like asking someone else about their age or income. I guess they figure if you know, you might tell someone. Such is the power of the IQ score. Mensa should acquire two books for its library. Stephen Jay Gould's The Mish Measure of Man and David Owen's None of the Above, Behind the Myth of Scholastic Aptitude. Both are classics of critical thinking about the science of intelligence. Both call into question some of the basic assumptions we make about intelligence, aptitude, and education. Gould's book traces the history of science's attempt to measure intelligence, from measuring skulls to weighing brains to test scores. Over and over, white, middle-class, male scientists found that white, middle-class, male brains were biggest, strongest, quickest. And regularly, a little while later, along came someone else who proved that their work was faulty, biased, and sometimes even fraudulent. Into the fray came Binet, the grandfather of IQ testing. His assignment was to devise a test which would identify children with learning disabilities so they could be helped. That was all. He specifically said, according to Gould, "The scale, properly speaking, does not permit the measure of intelligence because intellectual qualities are not superposable and therefore cannot be measured as linear surfaces are measured." Binet foresaw the potential difficulties for children if his system was used to rank them, as it is now. He worried about self-fulfilling prophecies. Quote, It is really too easy to discover signs of backwardness in an individual when one is forewarned. Binet refused to label the results of his tests as inborn intelligence. His successors in America, however, seized on mass intelligence testing as a way of life and abused the results in exactly the ways Binet had foreseen, and a few he'd not as well. The results of the first mass intelligence test, conducted by the US Army in World War I, were used as evidence in favour of limiting immigration in the 1924 congressional debates. David Owen's book concentrates on a later outgrowth, the SATs. These scholastic aptitude tests are taken by all American teenagers who want to go to college. The idea behind them sounds all right. America is huge, state curricula differ, and colleges need some way of comparing the many applicants from different areas and different schools. So far, so good. Owen, however, shows, often hilariously, that what the SATs really test is your ability to think like the people who designed the test. He explains how the questions work, how to identify the correct answers without doing the arithmetic, and even gives a short course in how to answer questions about the content of the provided paragraphs without actually reading them. The SATs were administered by the Educational Testing Services in Princeton, New Jersey. Most students assume a connection with Princeton University. There is none. The ETS is an independent, secretive organization which has parlayed tests into a fortune, tax-free, and which administers more tests every year. ETS now supplies tests for licensing teachers, hairdressers, golfers, and many others, and for admitting graduate students, law students, and medical students. It's quite an empire. ETS reacts a bit like the British government when challenged. They claim superior knowledge, refuse to give information, and lose any inquiries in red tape. They also accuse critics of wanting to destroy the fabric of society. A bit excessive, perhaps. Fortunately, America has a legal system which allows challenges even to its major institutions. Recently, a court ruled that New York State's use of SAT scores to award state scholarships discriminates against girls. This was the first time a court has ever confirmed the SAT's sex bias. Result? New York State is designing a new test. Oh well. The criticisms these books raise are biting, legitimate, and undoubtedly right on the money. And yet, it's very hard to shake the nervous feeling that there must be something in it. It's so accepted. What would I rather believe? That I think exactly like the unoriginal, conservative, middle-class white men who designed the tests? Or that I really am smarter than 99% of the rest of the population? When I was a kid, I had a badge which was an advertising gimmick for General Electric. Be nice to me, I'm going to be a genius someday. I guess I'm still working on it. That was IQ tests continue to flourish in spite of inherent biases because we so badly want to feel special. Written by Wendy Grossman, first published in December 1989. Next up this week, we have Cleo Balinas's May 2023 article, A Double-Edged Sword, Should We Be Labeling Kids? Read by Mike Hall.
There is no doubt, at least in my mind, that childhood and certainly teenage years have become progressively harder over the last 30 years. There are many and varied reasons for this. Social media is undoubtedly a mixed blessing, benefiting some youngsters and harming others, but the pressures on children to conform are greater than ever. Being continually measured against your classmates for the league table that the school's reputation depends on is another factor. Rates of anxiety and depression in teenagers have been steadily rising, and this has got worse over the pandemic. Along with this increase, more children are being diagnosed as neurodiverse. This is partly because the parameters for diagnosis have changed, but also because of increased recognition in children who aren't seriously disabled by their condition. Before we look at some of the pros and cons of labels, I should mention that there is substantial literature on labeling theory, which I don't propose to examine here. I will simply look at a few common applications of labels and whether they are helpful or otherwise in practice. Labels can be helpful. Labels change the attitude of the observer. If a teacher knows that a child is neurodiverse, they may cease to use unhelpful labels such as naughty and have ready-made plans that can be implemented. The label may also help the individual understand some of their own difficulties. I am autistic, and that's why I'm having to work harder to understand what someone is feeling when my friends just seem to know. A mental health label can also help a youngster feel validated. I am depressed, I'm not just being difficult, so it's valid for me to take time out. The label can also suggest potential ways forward, such as engaging in therapy. A label is often a diagnosis, and NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, recommends treatments by diagnosis, looking at the evidence to recommend the best treatments and therapies. Labels, therefore, can be useful. They can validate the individual, suggest treatments, and act as shorthand for others to begin to understand and help. Or not so helpful. Labels also have many and various downsides. The harms and benefits depend on the type of label, so it's worth addressing them separately. Identifying that a child is neurodivergent is helpful for that child, but what about the borderline between diagnosis and no diagnosis? Although we could talk about a spectrum, on the face of it, we acknowledge that there is no hard and fast cutoff. In reality, the situation is treated as a clear binary. You are either neurodivergent or you are not. Someone may have many traits but just miss the cutoff. So despite having the same difficulties as the child who falls just on the other side of the line, they will be treated entirely differently. Schools often say that they treat the child, not the label, but the reality is that without the label, there may be no help forthcoming, and certainly no extra resources or exam breaks. This is not a problem of the label for the child who has one, but it is a problem inherent in any label which has a relatively arbitrary cutoff. It would be excellent if we were able to treat all children as individuals who have traits along a spectrum, some of which needing support more than others. But the realities of our society and its resource allocation make this impossible. More serious psychiatric labels can be more contentious, primarily because most psychiatric diagnoses are still based on an understanding of clusters of symptoms rather than underlying pathology. We know now, for example, that schizophrenia is probably the final manifestation of a number of underlying processes which may respond differently to treatment and take different pathways through life. NICE does a good job of identifying which treatments are likely to be most effective for whom. Their recommendations are based on large RCTs, but they are statistical, so don't necessarily indicate which treatments will be best for any specific individual. This reality can be seen in trials for antidepressants. Trials suggest them to be somewhat effective, while clinical experience suggests that they vary from being life-saving to being completely ineffective. With no way to differentiate between the groups, a large trial may find such a treatment, on average, moderately effective. Work is being done to understand more, but there are still many unknowns. Talking therapies, social support, and psychological support are also important, but different people will appreciate different forms of assistance. A label can induce a lazy, that person has X, I know what to do with X kind of approach. Yet one person's experience and what they found helpful may not carry at all to somebody else. It is common to hear that those who have been through something understand it best, but they may simply understand how it was for them and then misapply that understanding to other people. There is a risk that others will see the label, not the person. This can lead to a lack of curiosity about why someone may be struggling, assuming that the label tells you everything you need to know about them. Medically, it can lead to diagnostic overshadowing, new problems being overlooked or not investigated properly as they are presumed to be part of the diagnosis already known. People, especially teenagers, can do this to themselves. It is fairly common now to see someone describe everything they do as being because of their label. My ADHD made me do it, for example, when it has nothing to do with ADHD. A harmless example on social media is self-described empaths, as if empathy wasn't a normal human trait. This may just help someone feel a bit special, but more pernicious examples include numerous introvert memes, in which their extreme forms can lead to someone avoiding all social contact and attributing it to their introvert status. In reality, these memes often characterize social phobia, and while they may appear to offer comfort, misidentifying a problem which they could get help with and withdrawing from social contact is unlikely to be the best way forward. Identifying with an erroneous self-diagnosis also happens. Self-diagnosis can be helpful as a step toward getting more formal confirmation, where it is possible to do so, and getting help, where it exists. Commonly, people make reasonably accurate observations about themselves, but not always. This can happen for teenagers, particularly those with a troubled or chronic trauma background who are looking for explanations for their dysphoria. They may decide that they are autistic or that they have bipolar disorder, labels which might make life feel more bearable, but which might impede them receiving the kind of support they need. Upon learning that their self-diagnosis was erroneous, some people are relieved to learn that they do not have a specific diagnosis, but it can leave others feeling bereft if they lose what they thought was the reason for their dysphoria. The balance. It may seem there are more downsides to mental health labels than there are advantages, but the advantages can be so significant that in practice they are not only here to stay, but useful. It is important, however, to bear in mind the downsides in order to mitigate them as much as possible.
That was Mike Hall reading Cleo Belinas' May 2023 article, A Double-Edged Sword, Should We Be Labeling Kids? And next up this week, from March 2023, we have Mark Horn's article, Hugo Talks a Lot, the prominent conspiracy theorist channel that recently found religion. A lot of conspiracy theorists either appeared or became very much more visible in the early days of the pandemic, including Hugo Talks, a prolific video content creator whose long-standing post-rock YouTube channel transformed in summer 2020 into a news commentary channel. The video started out as typical newspaper comments section complaints about lockdown rules, but turned very quickly into videos decrying MSM, mainstream media, propaganda, and worrying about the new world order. Hugo makes a lot of videos, sometimes more than one a day, so he's inevitably covered a wide variety of topics, from COVID-19 vaccines and the British royal family to UFOs and insect as meat products for kids. There's quite a lot of won't somebody think of the children, and an increasing amount of religious aspects, as Hugo seems to have become an active Christian during the course of his research and his videos. Although Hugo started on YouTube, where he has 143,000 subscribers to date, he's increasingly posting videos exclusively to his website, over concerns about them being taken down on YouTube. And he also has a substantial following on other social media sites, including Telegram, alternative video host Odyssey, and far-right and conspiracy theorist-friendly video host BitChute. This has also had the knock-on effect of making it harder to write an article covering every one of Hugo's frequent, varied, and interlinked theories, as the YouTube auto-generated transcript function is, obviously, not present on his own website-hosted videos. A typical video, like a recent one on smart devices, will take a real news story or issue, in this case the monitoring and privacy concerns that internet-connected devices pose, and run with it, positing a shadowy alternative explanation for the news story. In this particular video, as in many others, he claims that the fake stream media like the Daily Mail are part of a planned propaganda intended to control and mislead the public. Hugo's claim is that it isn't Chinese spying we should be worried about, but that of our own government, as these devices are a way for the UK and the US government to control their own population. He also throws some doubt on the claim that Russian criminals behind the technical problems recently experienced by Royal Mail. The evidence he presents for his alternative explanation don't rise above the level of insinuation, but mere insinuation can be effective to a casual audience, as there are genuine concerns here. We do know that Amazon does have recordings of chats you had around the house. UK energy companies do find it easier to switch you to prepayment if you were on a smart meter. Newspapers do often publish press releases uncritically, and Western intelligence agencies do have a far from unblemished record. None of this, however, is evidence that the Royal Mail cyber attacked themselves, or that a meta government is orchestrating the promotion of pointless smart devices as part of some nefarious plot. It's the 2023 equivalent of some bloke down the pub telling you he reckons there's something fishy going on, except instead of a table of very tolerant friends, he's had an audience that can be as large as the population of Preston. Even with such a large audience, it may not be so bad if a few thousand people are convinced not to buy an internet-connected egg counter. But other videos delve into more unpleasant territory, from speculation about media coverage of the disappearance of dog walker Nicola Bully, to a claim that climate change science is gobbledygook and part of a secret plan to form the basis of a one-world religion. Which leads us to the people who Hugo seems to think run the world. Satanists, seriously, and the World Economic Forum. In one recent video on the World Economic Forum, Hugo describes the United Nations as Luciferian, over images of Baphomet, no less, and says that the world leader's enthusiasm at forums like the World Economic Forum for a new world order and a new international rules-based order are intended as a replacement for the old rules, which they want to throw away. But what old rules is Hugo referring to? Quote, "The moral and ethical blueprint that we've all lived under is the Ten Commandments. It's God's moral law, and our rules stem from that," unquote. Obviously, not everything that's considered immoral is also illegal, or vice versa. But accepting that law and morality do obviously intersect, what are we to make of Hugo's claims? It isn't clear whether Hugo believes that the law stemming from the Ten Commandments is true of, for example, China, which is one of the five permanent Security Council members of the UN, and home to almost 20% of the entire world population. China, a country where just 3% of people follow an Abrahamic faith, is unlikely to have the Ten Commandments as the basis of most people's moral code. However, and surprisingly for your non-legally trained author at least, like most countries in the world, China does in fact use a European or Roman Empire-inspired legal code, with additional influences including the Confucian-influenced Great Qing legal code and a socialist legal system. Obviously, neither Confucian nor socialist ethics and laws are dependent on the Ten Commandments. So while it's obvious that the Ten Commandments aren't the basis for the morals, ethics and laws we've all lived under, to repeat, there are really quite a lot of Buddhists, Hindus and non-Abrahamic groups in the world. If we are to be as fair as possible to Hugo, we should at least consider the civil law and common law influence on the majority of legal systems of the world. How far have these systems been influenced by Christianity, and more specifically, the Ten Commandments? Countless books and articles have been written on the influence and origins of law, including opinions that argue for and against the influence of Christianity, Mosaic law, and the Ten Commandments. But it seems uncontroversial to say that modern civil law is based on Roman law. This was codified by Christian emperors like Justinian and Theodosius, but these codes also incorporated plenty of pre-Christian Roman law, and also later developments in European civil law, such as the Napoleonic Code, which explicitly sought to remove any vestiges of religion or superstition from the law. English common law, based on customs and precedents, came together after the Norman Conquest, and gradually overturned the existing Anglo-Saxon law, which was itself influenced by, but not wholly based upon, Christian teachings, having arisen at a time when, of course, plenty of Anglo-Saxons were pagans. Indeed, the general direction of religious influence on law moves from a clearer separation of church and secular matters in medieval times and earlier to greater religious influence in the early modern era. In Sweden, for example, the Ten Commandments was actually incorporated into criminal law in 1608, but that was pretty much the high watermark. Even in Reformation England, where witchcraft and sodomy were criminalised in the 1500s, such a wholesale incorporation of Mosaic law was rejected as going too far. A lot happened in the next 400 years, but we all know that the influence of religion on law then wanes significantly as we get closer to the present day. If we focus more specifically on the Ten Commandments, it's hard to see exactly which of these Hugo thinks are about to be overturned by this satanic conspiracy. Let's consider the Church of England's version of the list. "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods but me." Well, that ship has long since sailed. Virtually all countries theoretically permit freedom of religion by law, although there are, of course, a number of states which have a pretty unpleasant record regarding religious freedom. "You shall not make for yourself any idol." I'm sure there have been rules banning idolatry in the past, but modern culture, for better or worse, has no problem at all with idolatry. "You shall not dishonour the name of the Lord your God." Sadly, this is still an issue with many countries maintaining laws against blasphemy, some of which involve the execution of the offender. I'm curious as to whether Hugo wants this one to be illegal in England and Wales, since it technically still remains on the books in Scotland and Northern Ireland. While there have been several resolutions where member countries at the UN sought to create what was effectively an international blasphemy law, the UN Human Rights Committee more recently adopted the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and says that countries with blasphemy laws are in breach of their obligations. Hugo, therefore, gets a full point here, as the UN is trying to stop this being illegal, albeit a pretty hefty caveat that I'll come to later. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Again, there's no need for a satanic plot, as this commandment is already a goner. If we take Sunday opening of shops as a loose proxy indicator, most countries either never had laws about this or repealed them. Honour your father and mother. Sure, generally speaking, this is good, with some obvious exceptions. Some people do have really awful parents. I'm unclear on exactly how this relates to the law in Hugo's theory. The UN is in favour of the rights of the child, which some people do see as threatening to the parents, so perhaps we can give Hugo half a point here? Only half, though, as the UN is not specifically against honouring your parents. You shall not commit murder. So, murder was, unsurprisingly, illegal in codes prior to the Ten Commandments, such as that of Ur-Nammu, more than 4,000 years ago. Even if every current believer was to abandon Christianity tomorrow, my money's on murder remaining a bit of a taboo. You shall not commit adultery. This was also illegal prior to Moses. Thankfully, such laws, which were historically used to primarily target women, aren't in place in a majority of countries. The UN is publicly against laws banning adultery, but as this law didn't arise because of the Ten Commandments, Hugo gets another zero here. You shall not steal. Laws against theft are found as early as Hammurabi, therefore predating Moses by about 400 years. Much like murder, it seems hard to imagine this prohibition changing. You shall not be a false witness. Also illegal under the Code of Hammurabi. And while we're no longer executing perjurers, this is a law that's quite obviously staying. You shall not covet anything which belongs to your neighbour. So this isn't a crime, as we can't see inside people's minds. Even believers point out that coveting is a sin, not a crime to be punished by earthly judges. So from a possible of 10, Hugo gets a point and a half. Beyond the list, and I'm aware that I'm far from the first to point this out, many laws and morals which we all consider of extremely high importance in 2023, from slavery to sexual assault, are nowhere to be found in the Ten Commandments. I said I'd come back to that full point that I gave Hugo, as the UN is arguably seeking to remove the prohibition of dishonouring the name of God. Blasphemy is a law that exists in many jurisdictions, and it does seem somewhat attributable to the Ten Commandments. As mentioned earlier, in the same video, Hugo says they want a one-world religion so they can get away with things that would not be allowed under the Ten Commandments. The UNHRC call for an end to blasphemy laws. It's specifically demanding that people have the freedom to worship and believe as their conscience dictates, the precise opposite of a one-world religion. Hugo does talk, a lot, to a fairly sizable audience, but little of what he says makes any sense under even the lightest of scrutiny. That was Mark Horn's March 2023 article, Hugo Talks a Lot, the prominent conspiracy theorist channel that recently found religion. And finally this week, from September 2023, we have Brian Eggo's article, I Called Scottish Water to Solve My Supply Issues, I Never Expected Them to Bring Dowsing Rods, read by Paul Jenkins.
My masculinity isn't as toxic as it used to be. The LD50 has increased with age and proximity to wisdom, but one of the remnants of the former me is a desperate need to at least pretend I know what assorted tradespersons are referring to when they talk to me. "Where's your Toby?" asked the kitchen fitter. "I don't know," was my partially honest reply. I'm pretty sure that he wasn't inquiring as to the whereabouts of the nearest carvery, so the fact that I didn't know what a Toby was meant that I couldn't possibly know its location. Awkwardness avoided, partially. Some discreet Googling told me that, quote, "A Toby is the water shut-off valve, generally located at the boundary of your property, that sits between the council water main and your private water pipe, close quote. Cue an aimless and ultimately fruitless meander around the front and back of my house to try to locate it. Toby or not Toby? Considering the age of my plumbing, the kitchen fitter had recommended a new stopcock, insert your own punchline. This meant I was tasked with contacting Scottish Water to see if they could shed some light on the location of my elusive valve. A phone call to Scottish Water only confirmed that, due to the age of my house, similar to me, approximately 50 years, they didn't have accurate records of where the Toby might be located, and they'd have to send out an operative to try to locate it. The first engineer to arrive spent a good 40 minutes looking around the front and back of the house and along the street. In terms of technology, there was a classic metal detector, but also what appeared to be an electromagnetic detector. Sadly, they were unable to hit the mark, and as he was leaving, I joked, "Maybe bring your dowsing rods with you next time." Strangely, instead of a laugh, he informed me that he didn't have his with him today. I kept my poker face on because it's not wise to antagonise the people who will determine whether the installation of a kitchen you've already paid for will actually happen or not. He marks a couple of points on the path outside that may have potential and heads off with the promise that the digging team should be out within the next week. Rod Steward. For the blissfully unaware, dowsing is an old and highly discredited method of attempting to find water, oil, and other valuables using sticks, metal rods, and other such inert devices. They are generally understood to be working as a result of the ideomotor effect, similar to Ouija boards. Amongst the most notorious use of such devices was for bomb detectors, as was covered by Myrian Jones at QED in 2016. Divining intervention. Two fruitless digs later, and we're still at square one, with nothing found. Another phone call to Scottish Water, and they send out engineer number two. He's polite, eloquent, and clearly energised by the conundrum he's been met with. He talks at length about the historical lack of detailed data about pipe location, the shortcuts that have been taken to serve multiple houses with single valves, but he at least knows the location of the main pipe that serves the street. Put a pin in that. So he's confident he's closing in on the target. The confidence wanes somewhat after a half hour of fruitless searching. I wade back in with my dowsing rods joke just in case engineer number one was an anomaly. Sadly not. Engineer number two heads back to his van and returns with his dowsing rods. They look very familiar to me because I've got my own set, which we at Glasgow Skeptics use to demonstrate to the public how they don't work under controlled conditions. Engineer number two then proceeds to demonstrate the dowsing rods to me. He's not quite sure how they work, but they definitely do. To prove his case, he shows me the rods clearly moving and crossing over as he walks up to directly above the main pipe serving my neighbourhood. Okay, this is where you take the pin out. My poker face slipped somewhat at this point, but my teeth remained firmly clamped on my tongue. Pipe dreams. It's hard to put into words the highs and lows that came to pass in the next three unsuccessful visits. A Toby was found in a garden a few doors down, using good old human eyeballs, but it only fed the first four houses on the street. Mine is house number six. Another Toby was found a few doors up, also leveraging the power of vision, but it had been blocked by some concrete poured for a fence post. A dig team was dispatched the following week to put a new valve in close by, after which we found it fed houses 8 to 12 on the street, leaving me and my next-door neighbour high and far from dry. The final roll of the technological dice from engineer number two was to have me run my taps at full pressure and use sound detection equipment to try and find the path of water from the main pipe towards my garden. This unfortunately failed, which meant that a desperate last resort had to be taken. A dig team had to lift slabs in my garden just outside the kitchen window, then dig by hand to get to the pipe running to my house. The excavator could not be used, so it took a significant manual effort working through some particularly unpleasant soil to get to the pipe. Once that was located, they fitted a valve. It's worth pointing out that the real technology that the engineers had at their disposal failed to do the trick, but it was for valid reasons. Pipes can be made of differing materials. They can be too deep for detection. Soil types have an effect. And of course, it's pretty common for enthusiastic councils or homeowners to cover over valves. All along the way, the dowsing rods that definitely work proved to be useless. Repetitive drain injury. This is not the first time that Scottish Water and other water companies across the UK have been taken to task for their continued use of pseudoscientific methods. Back in 2017, science communicator Dr. Sally LePage contacted a number of companies to inquire as to their use of dowsing rods. The result was disappointing, to say the least. Scottish Water confirmed by Twitter that dowsing rods were used, but later poured some cold water on that confirmation, presumably after being doused with understandably negative publicity. I messaged Engineer Number 2 after all the work was done to thank him for everything he had done, but also revealed my connection to the sceptical community and offered to put his dowsing skills to a controlled test. I received no response. I therefore decided to reach out to Scottish Water's media team and got the following statement. Quote, Scottish Water does not support or encourage the use of dowsing and provides its employees with equipment and training to ensure they use methods for finding underground assets and leaks, which are scientifically tried and tested. These include ground microphones, correlators and metal detectors and other devices to pinpoint the exact location of underground assets and leaks. Scottish Water does not budget for or spend money on any form of divination or dowsing tools and training. Very occasionally, an operative may use rods if they feel it would help locate a leak, but this is not an officially sanctioned method, and it is down to individuals. Close quote. Water retention. I thanked Scottish Water for their response and for the hard work and dedication of the team to resolve my problem. Everybody I dealt with was polite, professional, and understanding of my problem. Even though it wasn't an emergency, they were aware I was on a timeline. They used state-of-the-art equipment, leveraged all of their experience and expertise, and moved metaphorical mountains of soil with multiple digs. With a logical process of elimination and investigation, they did the best they could with an incredibly difficult situation. I just wish they didn't muddy the Scottish Water by giving any kind of credence to such a clearly nonsensical practice.
That was Paul Jenkins reading Brian Eggles' September 2023 article, I called Scottish Water to solve my supply issue. I never expected them to bring dowsing rods. And that's all for this episode of the Skeptic Podcast. If you enjoyed what you've heard, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit skeptic.org.uk for more expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and claims of the paranormal. You can support the Skeptic on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/theskeptic, and you can follow us on Blue Sky at skeptic.org.uk. The Skeptic is produced by the Merseyside Skeptic Society in association with the Good Thinking Society and is edited by me, Michael Marshall. Today you've heard articles from Wendy Grossman, Cleo Bellinas, Mark Horn, and Brian Eggle.